Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'll be reading with you today, World Radio Magazine in digest form for May 2008. World Radio is published by Armand Noble. Armand's call is N6WR. The editor is Nancy Cott, WZ8C. World Radio officers are at 2120 28th Street, Sacramento, California, 95818. The phone number, area 916-457-3655. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512. Or at email address, handyham@courage.org. Our website is www.handyham.org. Let's go right to the editor's log, our normal place to begin the readings. First, a few words from our publisher, Armand Noble, N6WR. There has been much hue and cry about the lack of growth on amateur radio, a great deal of it taking on the sky is falling tone. Well-meaning amateurs agreed that in order to keep the numbers up that it would be necessary to drop the dreaded barrier of a CW test, that's Morse code, and to get the theory test down to the learner's permit level. Let us look at another affectation that is probably the closest to amateur radio, in that it is federally licensed and steady and a test is required. That is private pilot. According to the website of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association seen on 25 March 2008, and we quote, since its peak in 1980, the overall pilot population has declined by 25%, even as the general U.S. population has expanded by roughly the same percentage. In 2006, the pilot population dipped below 600,000 for the first time in decades, close quote. The AOPA statement went on to say, quoting again, without a mentor to support and guide them, 51% of student pilots are still students after 1 year of flight training. Only 14% have earned their private pilot certificate, and 35% have dropped out entirely. A student with a mentor is three times more likely to complete their training and earn their certificate, close quote. There could be as many opinions and conclusions to this as there are interested parties. First, and most important, the AOPA, to my knowledge, has not proposed making the ground school and the flying tests any easier. One might venture that, radio, flying, whatever, people don't like to study as people once did. The Wall Street Journal very recently did a story about American high school students. In the fields of reading, math, and science, our students in competition did not rank in the top 15 worldwide in any field. That's scary. I'm not wishing to play amateur sociologists. Those actually qualified to professionally comment are invited to write in. But it seems that the rapidly descending membership in such worthy service clubs like Lions, etc., is analogous to the decline compared to rise in population of amateur radio. There may be factors of a more ponderous nature to all this than the tedium to some of learning of Morse code and Ohm's law. That commentary was signed by Armand Noble, N6WR. To help us be proactive and part of the solution instead of part of the problem, we are starting a new column this month, Promotion and Recruitment, written by D, that's spelled D-E-E, Logan, W-1-H-E-O. We believe that Elmer's mentors are crucial to keeping a new ham in the amateur service. Getting interested people connected with radio clubs and developing healthy, active clubs is essential. We hope this column will be a two-way street, with you contributing your suggestions and experiences. If you're at the hamvention, stop by and say hello to the crew at the World Radio booth. The FISTS organization will have plenty of free K7QO code course discs at the FISC CW Club booth, so if you don't have your copy yet, come and get it. Practice 10 minutes twice a day, and next year at Hamvention, you could be copying 30-plus words per minute. We hope to see you there. 7388 Nancy Cott, WZHC. Nancy goes on to say, thank you very much for caring enough to take the time to let us know how you feel. Please keep in touch either through our webpage, www.wr6wr.com, or email Nancy directly to nancy@tir.com. Or you can actually go to the editor as well, editor@wr6wr. Let's take a peek at World Radio News Front. Amateur radio news courtesy of ARRL Letter and Newsline. Volunteers needed for 2010 Winter Olympics. The 2010 Winter Olympics is seeking amateur radio volunteers. The Vancouver Olympics Committee has given Radio Amateurs of Canada details of their search for ham radio volunteers to assist during the 2010 Olympic Winter Games and Paralympics Winter Games. Of the 25,000 volunteers required, amateur radio operators are especially needed to help in technical roles during the events and perhaps earlier. Volunteers must have their own local accommodation in Greater Vancouver or Whistler areas. The online volunteer application form is at www.vancouver2010.com. Include space to list skills and experience. If the applicant wishes a communications or technical role, he or she should add a key phrase in their application form to make it easy for planners to identify them. And on the fifth application page, add the words amateur radio operator in a box marked additional information. Again, if you want to volunteer to provide communication support for the 2010 Olympic Winter Games and Paralympic Winter Games, go to www.vancouver2010.com and fill out the form. Radio Amateurs of Canada, thanks you very much. Kosovo added to the CQDX listing. Kosovo is being added to the list of countries and territories recognized for CQDX awards, effective immediately. CQDX Awards Manager Bill Williams and 4UF announced today, verifications for contacts made on or after 17 February 2008 are acceptable for CQDX Award credit. CQDX Honor Roll members with 335 or more credits should update by 31 May. All Kosovo contacts will count for field KN on applications for the CQDX Field Award. Kosovo's status has been the subject of some controversy in the amateur radio community, as well as the world community, as the ARRL declared that special operations from there on 17 February will count as Serbia, not Kosovo, in terms of DXCC credit. The United States and many European countries immediately recognize Kosovo's independence. However, Russia and China are opposed to it, and Russia has threatened to veto any UN action to recognize Kosovo as an independent nation. CQ Magazine editor Rich Mawson, W2VU, stated, because it is CQ's policy to grant credit for contacts with new entities as of the date that their status changes, we have decided not to wait for UN action, but to follow the lead of the United States and other countries that have recognized Kosovo's independence and to grant credit for contacts made with stations in Kosovo as of its Independence Day, 17 February 2008. This action does not affect the country list for the CQWWDX contest. CQ Worldwide rules state that its country list is composed of those entities on the DXCC list and the WAE, that's Worked All Europe, award list. If the Worked All Europe committee decides to add Kosovo to its list, it will automatically be added to the CQWW listing. That was filed by W2VU. Here's an interesting short piece in the news front. Amateur Shootout. The Egyptian Radio Club 2-meter antenna shootout will be held 04 May 2008 It's going to be 11 May if it rains at Pleasant Ridge Park in Fairview Heights, Illinois. It's a home brew antenna contest. That means you make your own. You get points for how well it works, transmitting, and how goofy it looks. A $5 entry fee, and the winner gets half the entry fees. Potluck lunch, so bring the whole family. If you're interested, contact Frank Shears, S-H-E-A-R-S, call K7RMJ. Here's the email. The country Cuban, it's cuban9@charter.net or www.w9aiu.org. GPLS Superlaunch, the Great Plains Superlaunch, is the premier conference for near space explorers and enthusiasts dedicated to the education and study of aerospace science. It will be held this year on 31 July through 03 August at William Jewell College, 500 College Hill, Liberty, Missouri. The GPSL is an annual event for amateur radio and high-altitude balloon hobbyists to get to share information and launch multiple balloons for recovery. In the effort to launch and track simulated satellites to the 100,000-foot altitude of near space, these groups must apply their knowledge of balloons, weather prediction, amateur radio telemetry, and engineering. GPSL co-hosts are Near Space Ventures and Cap and Space. Here's another quickie in World Radio News Front for anxious new ham. Buckmaster Publishing is excited to announce a new service for people who have taken their amateur radio exam and are waiting to see what their new call sign will be. We will notify them by email of their new call sign as soon as it's released if they fill out the form at http://hamcall.net/newhams. That's hamcall.net/newhams. So if you know someone who will be taking an exam soon, please let him or her know about this service. That was furnished by KG4QIR. Annual Armed Forces Day, Crossband Military Slant Amateur Radio Communications Test. That's 10 May 2008. The author for this piece is Bill Sexton, call N1IN/AAA9PC. The Army, Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard are co-sponsoring the annual Military Amateur Radio Communications Test in celebration of the 58th anniversary of Armed Forces Day, AFD. Although the actual Armed Forces Day is celebrated on Saturday, 17 May 2008, the AFD Military Slant Amateur Cross Band Communications Test will be conducted 10 May 2008 to prevent conflict with the Dayton Hamvention, which this year is 16 through 18 May, which is the same weekend as the actual Armed Forces Day. The annual celebration features traditional military to amateur crossband communication single sideband voice tests and copying the Secretary of Defense message via digital modes. These tests give amateur radio operators and shortwave listeners, SWLs, an opportunity to demonstrate their individual technical skills and to receive recognition from the Secretary of Defense and or the appropriate military radio station for their proven expertise. QSL cards of acknowledgement will be provided to those stations making contact with the military stations. Special commemorative certificates will be awarded to anyone who receives and copies the Digital Armed Forces Day message from the Secretary of Defense. This month's May issue of World Radio Magazine has a very nice piece here with the Handy Hams. As many of you who listen on a regular basis probably know, this very same recorded material is sent along to the Handy Hams. In fact, it's enlarged by another 10 minutes into an hour format or more, if need be. And the Handy Ham system, the Courage Handy Ham system, puts it on their website and also supplies CDs or cassettes to people that are aspiring to or are already amateur radio operators who are print impaired. So let's go with the Handy Hams. It's titled Reeling Them In by Patrick Tice. Call is W80TDA. Have you ever gone fishing? I remember going fishing for the first time with my dad when I was maybe 7 or 8 years old. It was thrilling to reel in a fish that I caught all by myself. Working a ham radio station can be a lot like catching a fish. You are always on the lookout to find DX, that's distant countries. To make that contact with a station, you need to complete your work to all states or just make a new friend on the air. Anyone who fishes will tell you that having the right bait is important, even vital, to your success. Knowing the right way to listen on the bands, where to find the activity, and how to throw out your line, put out your call, are all important facets of reeling in that contact. However, in ham radio, we need to reel in more than contacts. We need to fish for new hams, people of all ages from all walks of life, with or without disabilities, to build our ranks and keep the amateur radio service healthy. I have some ideas about this, but if I am going to catch some new fish, I'm going to need some pretty good bait. How about a brand new handheld radio for every handy ham member passing the technician test at this summer's Minnesota Radio Camp? One of the biggest challenges for any amateur radio club is recruitment. And a ham radio camp faces a similar challenge. Although we do our best to keep amateur radio clubs and the general public informed of our activities and about the services we offer to people with disabilities, sometimes it can be very difficult to recruit new campers. Can we count on you to inform people you might know who could benefit from our services? Here are some useful things to know about radio camp. Put these in your fishing tackle box and use them to bait your line. Point. The cost of Handy Hand Camp is based on ability to pay. You or some other person with a disability can afford to come to camp. Point. Camp is for people with disabilities who aren't members of Handy Hams, and membership is only $10 per year. If a prospective member cannot afford the $10, we will find a sponsor for that person. Point. Thanks to a generous donor, radio campers who earn their technician class licenses at camp will each be given a new handheld radio by the Handy Ham Equipment Program. They will be able to return home to await the arrival of their new license and the arrival of those new radios, too. Point. The typical camper is teen through adult. You are never too old to attend radio camp. Our oldest successful tech licensee at camp 1 year was 84. Point. We meet you at the local airport or bus station near camp. Who wants to worry about ground transportation? And yes, we do have a lift van if you use a wheelchair. Point. If you use a personal care attendant, don't worry. We attend to all of your care needs at camp. We have a camp nurse and a doctor, too, Dr. Dave, KN0S, who also teaches extra class. Point. If you already have your technician ticket, you can study for general. If you have the general, you can study for extra. And if you have extra, you can sign up to participate in our fun-filled operating skills class. Point. Camp Courage North is less like a camp than a resort. Modern buildings, wheelchair ramps, K0LR audio beepers for blind navigation, and a pristine lakeside setting in the tall pines of Minnesota's lake country will make the week a memorable one. So there you are. Now, let's go fishing. Here's where you can send your catch. Courage Handy Ham System. Handy Ham is spelled H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, one word. Courage, Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, MN 55422. Our toll-free telephone number is 1-866-426-3442. You can email to hamradio, one word, hamradio, at courage.org, or on the website, www.handyham.org. That's Pat Tice's article, Reeling Them In. Pat's call again, WA0TDA, with the Handy Hams. Here's some information for local radio clubs, DX programs for your club meetings. Movie maker Jim Brooks, call 9-Victor-1 Yankee Charlie. That's 9-V-1-Y-C. That's two new D-Expedition videos out. One deals with the 2006 Comedic Island ZL-8R operation. The other chronicles the 2007 VS-7/8 Scarborough Reef operation. Both are professionally produced, broadcast-quality documentaries on DVD. More about these and Jim's other 8 D-Expedition films are online at www.dxvideos.com. That's www.dxvideos.com. Well, radio extends happy birthdays to three gentlemen, Ed LaRue, W6BEM 99, Harry K. Wolf, W6NKT. Harry is also 99, and also Norm Brooks, K6FO. They just say he looks good. I guess they didn't want to admit his old age. Hi. Thinking back a few minutes in this recording, I mentioned during the editor's log that there is a new section. It's titled Promotion and Recruitment, and here it is. Ensuring the Future of Amateur Radio and Our Radio Clubs by Devere D. Logan, call W1HEO, Whiskey 1, Hotel Echo Oscar. Imagine a future where there is no amateur radio. Gone are its frequencies, sold to the highest bidder by the government. Gone is ham radio's public service. Gone is the fun and enjoyment we treasure in our wonderful hobby. No way, you say? We hope not, but nothing is certain in this world. Ham radio is not ours by divine right. It must be considered of value by those who allocate our frequencies, or the end is near. This new World Radio column will focus on what we can do to ensure the solid future of amateur radio. We'll talk about how we can inform the public about our radio service and its value to the community. Ideas and case histories from radio clubs and individuals will be shared in this column. Good communication efforts will be recognized. Best practices will be discussed and more. So you ask, why now? Charles Kittering said, "My interest is in the future because I'm going to spend the rest of my life there." We should heed his words. There are signs today that amateur radio's growth rate is slowing from the robust days of the post-war era. Currently, there are 656,000 FCC ham licenses in the United States, but not all are active. We could make this number dramatically higher in very few years if we become more radioactive in communicating the value of amateur radio. It's up to us. Who else will do it? While the ARRL, the American Radio Relay League, is supportive, it certainly isn't able to carry the word to our individual communities and its public officials, public safety personnel, schools, media, and other key people. Nothing is more valuable than one-on-one contact, and this makes it a perfect project for our local clubs and radio hams. Growth itself brings many benefits. With more licensees, we can enjoy many synergies, with potentially more hams to assist with highly visible public service and emergency communications. There is strength in numbers, which can impress those who allocate our frequencies, not to mention politicians who can wield their influence. More licensed operators can also mean more radio club members. Many clubs are facing declining membership today. The reasons are well known. But if clubs become involved in promoting amateur radio and position themselves as the logical first step for interested persons, then numbers should increase. Being active is necessary. We can't be discouraged by the usual club critics whose negative perspectives can doom efforts before they begin. First, let's make a plan. 3 years ago, a few radio club members in the Cleveland, Ohio area were discussing the future of their groups and amateur radio in general. They agreed that there was a need for an organization that would help clubs with their ham radio promotion. The result was the formation of the Ham Radio Promotion Project. Its first members were the Indian Hills Radio Club of Wycliffe and Cleveland Chapter 1 of the Quarter Century Wireless Association, That's QCWA. The project's stated goal was to develop a cooperative effort by clubs and individual operators who would increase the number of licensees through an area-wide program of publicity and recruitment. Using a variety of established public relations and marketing principles, a four-step process was recognized as necessary. A key point was that publicity alone does not guarantee new licensees. The plan's overall approach, therefore, was to begin with various promotional activities and end with the successful recruitment and licensing of new hams. The four-step process. So how do we get from here to there? We identified four steps in the process, with each one linked. Like a chain, the connecting links must be sound in order to move ahead from each step to a successful conclusion. The first step is promotion. Activities include publicity through news releases and feature articles, demonstrations and talks, exhibits and displays, and personal contacts. Step two is prospecting. This involves identifying persons who appear interested in ham radio as a result of various promotional activities, providing contact information, elmers or helpers, and radio club locations. Step three is qualifying. Finding out which prospects are likely candidates for a license can be done by personal and radio club discussions, often involving elmers listed in a local help directory. Step four is training. Providing people with license examination preparation can be done with club-sponsored classes, individual help, or referral to online or local library sources. Now let's talk about what's really needed, the tools of the trade. Having developed a plan, the next step was identifying the tools necessary to help clubs with their publicity efforts. We took an inventory of available literature, training, promotional videos, etc. The results weren't encouraging. There were some pieces and parts, but a great many more were missing. For example, we could find no current video that would present an overall view of amateur radio and its many aspects. There was no how-to manual that would show clubs how to conduct a complete promotional campaign, including samples of news releases, exhibits, and articles. We found no comprehensive guide for elmers that would help them in their contacts with the public. Few good examples of promotional exhibits were located. So we began to produce the needed materials. Fortunately, with 40-plus years as a broadcaster and public relations director, experience was on our side. Our first project was to produce a good quality video that would be entertaining and informative. It would prove to be the cornerstone of the publicity phase, allowing hams to do public presentations very easily with little preparation. We were fortunate to get help from a former TV news director and a corporate communications professional, Frank Benish, called K8IFH. Frank handled production, did the narration, and made DVD copies of the final 22-minute video. The title of this effort is Amateur Radio, Wireless Window to the World. The video includes some history, explains ham radio, shows hams demonstrating various modes, highlights international friendships, and a de-expedition to Bhutan, the Dayton Hamvention, and information on licensing. Reaction to the video has been very positive. Those who have used it agree that it does the job of giving viewers a good overview of amateur radio. Copies of the video in DVD format were first provided to radio clubs that joined the promotion project. Additional copies are now offered to others at $20 each, with proceeds supporting the project. Information on ordering the DVD is found at www.neoham.org. So that's www.neoham.org. More details on how your club can crank up its own publicity machine will be included in future columns. In conclusion, in the meantime, let's hear what your club is doing to promote ham radio. Send us a summary of your activities, what works, what doesn't, how to interest various groups, and photos too. Send them to D, D-E-E, Logan, L-O-G-A-N, call W-1-H-E-O, 9901, Cypress Circle, Mentor, M-E-N-T-O-R, Ohio, O-H-44060. Or you can mail the material to the author, D-E-L-O-G-A-N, at Ameritech.net. DeVere, D. Logan, W-1-H-E-O, is a professional public relations counselor and writer who received the 2006 ARRL Philip McGann Silver Antenna Award for Public Relations. Let's pause for a moment and recognize three silent keys. This is, in effect, the amateur radio obituary part of the magazine. Rodney Dinkins, D-I-N-K-I-N-S, call A-C-6-V, Alpha Charlie 6 Victor. Rodney Dinkins, 76, died 16 February 2008 in Oceanside, California. Rodney was well known for developing and maintaining the website www.ac6v.com, a reference guide and index for amateur radio operators worldwide. He was also the author of a number of ham radio books. John Laza, spell L-A-E-Z-Z-A, call KB2MQL, Kilo Bravo 2, Mike, Quebec, Lima. John Laza died 10 March 2008. John was a great friend of all who met him. He was always with us on the bus trips to the Dayton Hamvention since the early 90s. A few of us were able to take advantage of his hospitality at his home on the island of Anguilla earlier this year. John will be sorely missed. That was submitted by Michael DePercio, KC2Q. And one more gentleman, Bernard A. Madrick, Jr., call WB2GGL, Whiskey Bravo 2, Golf, Golf, Lima. Bernard Bernie Madrick, Jr., 71, died 23 February 2008 at his home in Kansas City, Missouri. This obit was filed by Joe Fairclough, WB2JKJ. Joe goes on to reminisce just a little bit about his friend, Bernie Madrick, Jr. I met Bernie and his brother, David, in 1962 in New York. The month was September, and my ham radio license had just arrived in the mail. I met David on the air and discovered he lived five blocks away. David invited me to see his shack, where I also met Bernie. David, Bernie, and I became instant pals, and over the years we never lost touch. Bernie, more so than his younger brother, and I would meet at the local flea markets. That was sent in as a remembrance by Joe Fairclough, WB2JKJ. Let's move to an article now about emergency communications. It's titled Having Fun by Jerry Wellman, called W7SAR. Following a presentation for a radio group where I touted all the reasons for gathering gear and being ready, Avella posed a unique question. He asked, what do you do between emergencies? Great question. And it got me thinking. What I discovered with my introspection was that perhaps I've become too focused on one narrow but important facet of amateur radio. Just what do I do between emergencies? It's not like I live in a fire station where I can clean and polish big red trucks. I have to work a 40-hour-a-week job, which prevents me from attending training classes on a regular basis. What I found is that I spend a severe amount of time fiddling with antennas, batteries, power supplies, field rations, and getting gear ready for what? It's not as if I respond to an emergency daily, weekly, or even monthly. Then there's the expense. You and I justify spending what could be a lot of money by saying it's for emergency radio. I found a couple of antennas and magnetic mounts at a local surplus store, and of course, I added them to my gear. As I put them in the collection, it occurred to me that there were more antennas and magnetic mounts than I would ever use or could ever fit on top of our vehicles, all of which have a grundle of antennas already. I guess I would loan them to others if needed, but I have collected a lot of stuff. Then there was the great deal on the 50-amp power supply. It had a dent and was marked down significantly. But how many power supplies does one need? Can you have enough? My wife, the voice of sanity in our family, thinks we've hit the tipping point. And I'm starting to agree. The positive side is we're well prepared. The negative side is that it seems to occupy a lot of time and effort that may prevent me from smelling the roses and enjoying other aspects of the hobby. I also tend to associate with other like-minded amateur radio operators, and I may be missing meeting folk that are into DX, television, CW, and other specialties. A fella took me to task this past week when I was asking for input to an emergency radio plan. He said there are a lot of operators who are not ARIS members that have good ideas, and you would do a lot for ham radio by asking their opinion. And that was obviously a quotation. In short, by focusing on emergency operators, I'm missing the perspective of perhaps well-rounded operators. While I viewed myself as friendly to all that makes up amateur radio, my good friend pointed out that others don't share that view. With that in mind, I asked the input of a cross-section of operators and was thrilled with the response. Several simply said thanks for being involved, and others were more vocal and excited to be included. One operator said that in a dozen or more years as a licensed operator, it was the first time anyone had ever asked or invited her to participate in emergency operations of any kind. All of those I asked contributed great ideas and aspects I had not considered. I was both humbled and excited. I have learned that a great many operators might like to be involved, but need someone to simply ask them to come and participate. I have learned that the emergency operators do not have the market cornered on preparedness. There are a lot of people with wisdom and common sense and can contribute. I'll still remain focused on emergency preparedness and probably continue to gather more antennas and gear until our home overflows. However, I do think I will try to have a little fun between emergencies and attend more non-amateur radio emergency service events. Who knows? I might even try DX one of these days. With regard to responding, it's important to keep in contact while responding or when unseen. I've added to my briefing checklist the caution to remain on the assigned frequency when an operator is deployed. If the station unseen is to be on a specific frequency or repeater, that's where they need to stay. Let's say I'm responding to a flooding situation and am told to set up an HF-SSB link on 7268.5 kilohertz. The folks at home expect to find me there and are monitoring there for me. It's my lifeline if I get in trouble. If I decide that 75 meters is better suited, that's okay, as long as I tell the folk listening for me. But shame on me if I just decide to change frequencies and not coordinate the change. I've affected my ability to communicate and am causing volunteers to waste time listening to a frequency that I'm no longer using. On a communications blog, one operator asked a simple question. What do you carry in your go bag? Responses quickly evolved into, I can carry more stuff than you can. In reading some of the lists, I wondered what kind of large SUV various folk used and considered that some must have to tow a large trailer as well. Some operators claim they carry a large amount of test and repair gear, including some name brand and expensive SWR meters and stuff normally found and needed only in the shop. One operator listed all of the tools he carried, and many were so specialized I wondered how many situations he'd need these items for. And then there were several operators who carried large deep cycle batteries and huge amounts of wire and coax, not to mention portable towers and antenna. One person said he carried a box of various cellular phone chargers in case other responders had phones but no way to recharge them. This, I believe, is way beyond the role of emergency communicator. I did contribute the need for a single item that no one else had listed. This item has proven itself critical for me on more than one occasion, and it's an item I'd never leave home without. What, you ask, could be so critical yet not mentioned by others contributing to the blog? I carry a small roll of toilet paper in my bailout bag. It has been most needed in some very time-critical events. Another blog was discussing how people manage to install radios in today's vehicles. The photo that puzzled me the most was one of a late-model SUV with no passenger front seat. A radio rack had been installed in its place. I don't mind putting a few holes in my now-aging Ford Explorer, but taking out the front seat? Some of these blogs reminded me of my earlier years as a newly licensed EMT. I drove a tiny American Motors Gremlin. Remember those, folks? I carried a folding stretcher and a huge assortment of medical gear. In the several years I faithfully carried this stuff, I cannot remember a single time the stretcher came in handy. The medical stuff was often used, but never for emergencies. More often, my mom needed a bandage from my younger brother or sister for routine injuries around the house. I'm not saying we, radio operators, need to be unprepared, only that we use common sense. There are a few situations that require us to be first responders and provide the whole field communication setup, including a fully equipped repair facility. If you actually have a first responder role, you should be prepared. For a great many of us, the need is less a first responder role and more of a support role. It's not as important that we carry everything, but that we bring what's needed. We may want to consider having gear at home organized so that we could grab only what worked for a particular kind of event. In my earlier years, I realized it took me a lot of time to find gear when my vehicle was stuffed to the brim. I'd have to unload everything and find something, like the VHF radio or a screwdriver, commonly used, and then reload all the seldom-used gear. And you know, that repacking gear in wind, rain, snow, isn't as fun or efficient as loading it in the comfort of a warm summer day or in a garage. My own bailout bag of gear has now morphed into two bags of radios and batteries, and material I might really use on short notice. I've stopped carrying the portable tower, beam, connectors, antennas, hundreds of feet of coax, batteries, and extra radios that seldom, if ever, were needed. I have compared notes with other operators who have some on-scene experience and learned what worked well and what wasn't needed. I have my gear boxed and labeled at home so I can select what works for the assignment, and it makes it quicker to respond, and I notice I can get set up faster by not having to sort through boxes and boxes of extra stuff. And with today's price of fuel, I hate to consider what it costs in hauling around extra poundage I'd not need. As always, your needs vary and your situations differ. I would suggest you evaluate what is needed and what you have never needed and plan accordingly. One of the best MCOM gatherings I attended was a discussion about what works well in a response and what doesn't. For what I paid for my Bird watt meter and service monitor, I'm not taking them into the field. I'll tune my radios and check my antennas before I go, and use the cheap $20 SWR meter if I need a quick and close field measurement. And finally, just wondering, you know, one of those days when you're trying to avoid doing something constructive and your mind wanders, why don't they, whoever they are, make coax in colors? Like you, I have a lot of black coax, thin and thick. I also have a little bit of white RG58 that came from a marine band antenna. And then there is a short run of yellow coax I found attached to a field survey antenna that I presume is 50 ohm, but I'm not sure. I did find a roll of off-brand RG58 that is dark blue. But why not bright orange or green or red? I'm sure a lot of emergency communications folks would invest in brightly colored coax. It would make it safer when you cover walkways with antenna feeds. You could organize your field gear so that UHF was green, VHF was orange, HF was red, and special stuff continues as black. This is not the kind of emergency radio issues that keep me awake at night, but still, I wonder why they don't. Until next month, best wishes from Salt Lake City. The author, Jerry Wellman, W-E-L-L-M-A-N, call Whiskey 7 Sierra Alpha Romeo, W7SAR. Can be reached by sending mail to P.O. Box 11445, Salt Lake City, Utah, UT, 84147. Or you can send Jerry an email to the initial JW@DESNEWS.com. There's a nice little piece here in the Youth Forum section of the magazine, Coin Artist. Author Carol Perry, WB2MGP. Every teacher and instructor of ham radio classes with children knows how important it is to motivate our sometimes overstimulated and stressed out young people. Why should they want to learn what we are teaching them? For me, in 30 years of teaching, the answer was always the same. Hands-on, high motivation, and fun does it every time. The unit on magnets offered countless opportunities to incorporate all three of the above. One term, I was lucky enough to have a student's dad come in and open a small candy vending machine for us. Beside the fact that the lesson was a complete success because it ended with everyone getting a sample from the machine, the kids really did have fun with the hands-on follow-up lessons. I recently came across a book which had the perfect demonstration to use with the vending machine lesson. The name of the book is 730 Easy Science Experiments with Everyday Materials by Churchill, Losnick, and Mandel. The purpose of the book is to learn why each experiment works while having fun doing it. Their experiment called Coin Artist, that's C-O-I-N, you know, money, became a regular part of my lesson plans when discussing coin-operated vending machines and magnets. Materials, three large hardcover books, a bar magnet, three metal washers, four coins, a dime, a penny, a nickel, and a quarter. We showed the students how many coin-operated soda and food machines are able to catch fake coins, like slugs or washers, by using a magnet. Have each child put two books on top of one another and lean a third one against the stacked books to create a slide. Hold the bar magnet in the middle of the book forming the slide while the student drops each coin and washer down the side of the book past the magnets. The class will see that the coins slide past the magnet, but the washers are caught and held by it. The bar magnet was able to pick up or attract the washers because they are made of steel or iron. The magnet did not pick up the government minted coins because they are minted or made into coins from alloys or mixed metals that are non-magnetic. United States coins are a combination of copper and other metals. Since magnets will not pick up copper, they are useful in catching all the slugs or fake coins made of steel or iron that some people may drop into vending machines. I can't stress enough the importance of these hands-on projects when working with kids. We all remember best when we're involved, especially when it was fun time. Again, that piece was titled Coin Artists by author Carol, C-A-R-O-L-E, don't forget the E, Perry, P-E-R-R-Y, call WB2MGP. She can be reached by email at her call sign, WB2MGP@ix.netcom.com. We have a piece here from the QCWA, Quarter Century Wireless Association. It's titled VHF-DX and Scotch on the Rocks. The author, Alan Pickering, call KJ9N. My last column described for QCWA's debt to inventor Michael Faraday, the discoverer of electromagnetic induction, and much of our early theories in the field of diamagnetics. Writing that column reminded me that I needed to fill in the gaps between Faraday and some other early pioneering efforts, particularly related to amateur radio, the QCWA, and some early experiments in VHF DXing. Therefore, given the current interest in the beginning of Sunspot Cycle 24 and projections as to its benefits to the DX and QCWA community, I decided to tell you a little bit about VHF DXing, inasmuch as most of us rarely think of DX as being centered outside of the high-frequency bands or stemming beyond Marconi's first transatlantic QSO between Europe and the United States back in 1901. The first major VHF DX consisted, of all things, of a television picture from Europe to the United States in 1928, which was sent from the London laboratory of Scottish inventor John Logie Baird to Hartsdale, New York. John Baird was one of the original geeks of the world with a fertile mind and wide-ranging interests. Although he attended Glasgow University, his studies there were interrupted by World War I, and by the time the war was over, he had progressed in his knowledge so far on his own in the field of television electronics that he would have been totally bored by any classroom activities he might have undertaken. I said that Baird was one of the original geeks of his day. In Donald MacLean's biography of Baird, as one of Scotland's most famous, infamous inventors, an incident is recounted when Baird visited the London Daily Express seeking publicity to promote his invention of vertical slow scan television. The news editor was terrified of Baird's claims and was quoted as saying to another news staffer, "For God's sakes, go down to reception and get rid of the lunatic who's down there. He says he's got a machine for seeing by wireless. Watch him. He may have a razor on him." Some of that fear may have stemmed from the fact that Baird had a reputation for creating unintended consequences. In 1912, he had tried to make diamonds out of carbon granules by heating them in an electric furnace of his own design, but succeeded only in shorting out the entire electrical system of the city of Glasgow. He invented pneumatic shoes using semi-inflated balloons, but they burst on him. Because he suffered from cold feet, Baird invented a thermal undersock, which did become successful, and many Scotsmen remember him for his creation of the Baird sock. Ignoring entirely his pioneering work as the inventor of slow-scan television, as well as the first transmission of a TV picture across the Atlantic Ocean. As we all know, many claim to be the originators of television. A couple of years ago, one of my columns outlined the seminal contribution of Philo Farnsworth, who was the first to give us a horizontal raster based on his memories of plowing a field of corn. Farnsworth certainly had to be numbered among the pioneers, along with Vladimir Zwetskin. David Sarnoff is often given credit that should go to Farnsworth, since Sarnoff borrowed Farnsworth's ideas and rushed them to the patent office first. But to be perfectly accurate, we have to give first place to Scotsman John Baird, who demonstrated in February of 1924 that a semi-mechanical analog television system was possible by transmitting moving silhouette images in his London laboratory. A year later, he demonstrated an improved system in the lobby of a downtown London department store, transmitting a 30-line vertically scanned image at a rate of 5 pictures per second. And by the end of 1926, Baird had been able to increase the scan rate to 12.5 pictures per second. And on 03 July 1928, by using 3 scanning discs with 16 rotating holes per disc, Baird made the first color TV transmission. This was the same year he sent VHF TV pictures from Europe to the USA. By 1932, Baird had moved on, the first, to utilize UHF signals for his transmissions. And in 1944, he demonstrated a 1,000-line telechrome electronic system that was comparable to today's high-definition TV transmissions. Unfortunately, much that John Baird did in the 1940s has been buried deep in the secret military files of Britain's defense establishment, where they were originally considered top secret, and only now are being archived for historians and researchers to discover. All of us, the QCWA in particular, must be fully dedicated to professional growth and personal intellectual development. That is what makes us the elite, the proud, and the many, the QCWA. That is our challenge and our goal, to be better tomorrow than we are today in all aspects of amateur radio. So be it. That's it for this time, 73, and my best to you all, Alan, KJ9N. Alan Pickering, Kilo Juliet 9 November, can be reached by sending mail to 31860, Taylor Grade Road, Duet, D-U-E-T-T-E, Florida, F-L, 33834. Or if you prefer, you can email him at his call sign, which is KJ9N@ARRL.net. On the back cover is another piece of news from AR Newsline. I'll try to give you as much of it as I can in the next 3 or 4 minutes. 2008 Amateur Radio Newsline Young Ham of the Year Award nominations. If you know a young radio amateur age 18 or younger who has done something very special in the amateur radio field, this is the time to consider nominating him or her for the 2008 Amateur Radio Newsline Young Ham of the Year Award. The Young Ham of the Year Award is presented annually to a licensed radio amateur. That's the ham, who is 18 years of age or younger, is a resident of the 50 United States, Canada provinces, or Puerto Rico, and who has provided outstanding service to the nation, the community, or the betterment of the state of the art in communications through the Amateur Radio Hobby Service. All nominations must be received by 30 May 2008, so that's only a month, on an official application and accompanied by verification materials. Applications forms are available for a self-addressed stamped envelope mailed to the following: the Young Ham of the Year Award, care of, that's C-O, Newsline, 28197, Robin, R-O-B-I-N, Avenue, Santa Clarita, C-L-A-R-I-T-A, California, CA 91350. The nominating applications are also available for electronic download or online submission from our special award website at www.yhoty.org. Here are some of the things you should be thinking about in a nominee. First off, as noted above, the nominee must be age 18 or younger and a resident of the United States, Canada, or Puerto Rico. He or she must hold a valid amateur radio service license issued by the United States Federal Communications Commission or Canadian Telecommunications Regulator, Industry Canada. Also, your nominee should be someone who has done something outstanding as an amateur radio operator. Perhaps it was something special he or she did for his community through the amateur radio service. Maybe it was some outstanding achievement that led to an improvement in amateur radio in his or her area. Or perhaps he or she was successful in recruiting a lot of new hams. Well, folks, the article goes on a bit further, but you get the idea. So if you're interested, check out those resources there and get an application for some worthy young individual who's done something great for amateur radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this brings me up to time for the reading of World Radio Magazine for May 2008 in digest form. World Radio is published by Arm & Noble. It's headquartered at Sacramento, California. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams can be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. We have a great website and newsletter every week, www.handyham.org. My name is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. QTH, geographic location, southeastern Massachusetts, right on good old Buzzards Bay, on the way to Cape Cod. 73, enjoy your springtime. Bye-bye.